Thank you, Sheila. Hi, everyone. I got here a few hours ago, and I've had a whirlwind tour of what's been going on here at Cornell, and it is absolutely amazing. The commitment by the university to build LEED buildings, to integrate all of these things with the curriculum, helping you all understand it. There really is no separation between these things and what we all want to accomplish. I think it's a really great step forward. Okay, I'm going to talk about green buildings today and a little bit about why this phenomenon of buildings has kind of taken, in many regards, center stage in the whole sustainability debate. We've all understood for a very long time about sustainability, what the issues revolving around energy, water, waste, materials, human health, all of the social implications, climate change, all these things matter to a large degree. The population is growing exponentially. We're looking at a very short period of time, the year 2050, before the experts say we'll be at 9.2 billion human beings. This is a great shot of Turkey, a very dense city. There's about 15 million, somewhere between 15 and 19 million people, depending on how you want to count the extended population. But when you consider that the great majority, 50% of the world's population, is now living in cities that only occupy 2% of the world's landmass. So 50% of the population, 2% of the world's landmass, using up two-thirds of all energy, producing more than two-thirds of all CO2 emissions, obviously the direct correlation to climate change, 80% of the world's resources, and more than a billion tons of waste annually. This little percentage of the world's landmass, 50% of the population, causing all of that. Buildings, the way that my organization sees it, the way that the people that came together to start the U.S. Green Building Council, buildings are the way that we can at least do something dramatic about all of what we have just seen. There are so many things, you know, you'd love to say, you know, I want to do something for the environment. You know, I want to clean up rivers. I want to, you know, preserve forests. I want to do social equity support in order to help people that are disadvantaged all around the world. I want to do all those things. And some people will nosedive into one of those areas. What we decided to nosedive into was the building industry, because buildings essentially account for so much of the destruction of the Earth's natural resources and ultimately signal a way forward for all of us. Buildings are, in our opinion, the right moniker, the right area of focus, but only if the buildings perform. And by that, what I mean is we have to rethink every single thing that we think we know about buildings. And I find it easier to think about these buildings not as buildings themselves, but as boxes. We live in boxes. We go to school in boxes. We sleep in boxes at night. We worship in them. We eat in them. We buy clothing in them. They are boxes. And whether these boxes treat us with dignity as human beings or not, is really what we're here to talk about. Do they take care of us? Do they take care of the planet? Do they in fact inspire us? Do they give us any reason to want to focus on them in the first place? And I think what we've come to the conclusion of is this green revolution is, it's an amazing kind of journey that we were on, especially the last 5 or 6 years, where we had the freedom to think about new technologies and a world populated with photovoltaic cells and wind turbines versus coal-burning power plants. The political structure, the political world we live in today, especially here in the United States, I think it's somewhat fractured and broken. I think that we essentially have to choose what avenues we take on our own, and we have to not allow politics to influence what we know is right, what we know is important to transform lives, transform communities, improve human health, and do those things. And you know, when Sheila told you about this book, the beauty about this book is Paul Hawkins says, I forgot what chapter it was, I used to quote it, you know, right up front, but he says it's absolutely appropriate to be a capitalist and an environmentalist. And he says that essentially until people understand that solid link between them, when business understands I can be just as successful, I can make just as much money, I can make my shareholders happy, I can improve my relationship with my employees, and I can make a lot of money at the same time, all in the name of a healthier, more focused environmental company, then that will be the moment we really start to see the change in the world. And if you think about it, think of where we are right now. Think of the large multinational corporations that have put a massive stake in the ground relative to sustainability. And we're starting to see some of those changes happen. In the building industry, we've gone from thinking in terms of new large-scale buildings to what we're calling a retrofit revolution. Everything we talk about in green building, a lot of people lock on to the sexy, really interesting new buildings. But the existing building stock, about 96% of all the boxes that are out there, the existing building stock is where the greatest achievements in energy, water, waste, and materials can take place. I've got three slides. I think these are the most important slides in my whole deck. And I'm gonna run through my slides quickly because I've got a lot of them and I wanna save some time for Q&A. But these three slides basically show, this is US energy consumption. And it says by the year 2050, we're going to need approximately close to 68 to 70 quadrillion BTUs of energy to run the United States. Quads of energy. And I don't know how many quads a quadrillion BTUs are, but it's a lot of BTUs, okay? So this is where we are going and this is what we need to do. We have spent the last 10 years focused on the blue area, which is renewable energy, and we still should. That's an important part of the equation of the future. But we've spent a lot of time on that. The orange section was looking at the ability to put in new nuclear. And I think after the tsunami and the earthquakes in Japan, I think that's off the table. People are no longer thinking nuclear with any kind of degree of importance around the world. So we were thinking of this new emerging green revolution, the ability to lower that curve so we don't need 78 or 68 quads of energy. Let's bring it down to about 60 quads of energy through these things. And we got so excited. But my friend Ed Masria, who runs Architecture 2030, basically said, all we really need to do is start to focus on the embodied energy efficiency opportunity in the buildings that we are in right now. In these buildings, in all of the existing buildings around the United States. And in doing so, you can drop the energy demand to about 30 quads of energy by the year 2050. It's stunning, it's huge, it's an amazing, and think about the amount of CO2 that's reduced in that equation as well. But we don't do that. We focus on just the top end of that spectrum. This is where we need to understand better our opportunities for the future, because what we're talking about here is we're talking about energy consumption reductions, economic savings, we're talking about CO2 savings, we're talking about job creation, economic development, all the stuff that the left and the right fight about every Monday morning. You know, this strategy of looking towards our existing building stock and reducing the energy requirements as a result can do so much for us. So the U.S. Green Building Council came together, and I would say, to Sheila's point, we came with the idea of being somewhat disruptive. You know, when you say a business guy, a developer, an environmental attorney, it almost sounds like the beginning of a joke, and to a large degree. Yeah, except we didn't get into a fishing boat. We actually did begin this journey as, you know, we all cared about the environment. I actually cared because I worked for United Technologies Carrier Corporation, and my job was Director of Environmental Marketing, and I didn't know what that meant. And in 1991, there was no handbook for dummies that said this is what you do if you're going to be a sustainability director or the environmental director for marketing. So I tried to meet people that were even talking about the environment. David was one of them, David Gottfried. Paul Hawken was one of them. And, sometimes you get really lucky. I got invited to a meeting about 3 months after meeting David. I met Paul Hawken. I met Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute. I met Bill McDonough. I met Bill Browning. a variety of the authentic leadership of the Green Movement I was fortunate enough to meet. And it was enough to make me understand there's two paths I can take. I can take one, which is the pathway to greenwashing, which you essentially try to do your best and you hope it's green and you stick PV up on the roof and you say, wow, look at us, we're green. Or you could take the other road, which is a lot more difficult. Sheila mentioned the 7 years the phone didn't ring, and that actually happened. But the ability to take that other road and really begin the grassroots movement to change what we know about the world that we live in today. And in 1993, if anybody said that we would in fact be able to change the world's, the modern real estate movement, I think accounts for more than 15% of GDP. You think about the embodied, how many large-scale developers and owners in cities with codes and mandates, how much onerous stuff is associated with all that. The idea that these three guys in the fishing boat are going to have any influence on that just seems unthinkable. Well, you know, the three guys transformed into a movement, and I'll show you some slides on that. But that movement is, in fact, making the change all around the world. It's no longer a U.S.-centric endeavor. This is all around the world, and we're starting to see what we had taken for granted about capitalism and about industrialism, and starting to see the change that we're really trying to evolve to. Understanding we have this in our hands, we have the ability, and that's what I think people didn't feel for a very long time. So a few players came together, and then we started the U.S. Green Building Council, and then we decided that we would form committees, and these committees would look at energy and water and waste and materials, innovation opportunities, globalism. We would form all these committees, and what we've found recently is we actually have a spear point. I like that because I'm into war metaphors lately. But we also have a voice. If you think about having a voice where we actually go to Capitol Hill frequently in D.C. And what used to be congressional staff saying, why are those people in the hallway? They are now actually pulling us into their congressional offices because they want to align themselves with a movement that has really so much positive things going on. What we did, very simple. We were an organization called U.S. Green Building Council. We wanted to shift the market to sustainability, market transformation. And trust me, our goals were very simple. They still are to a large degree. But we thought to do that, we need two things, the most important being a rating system, and that's LEED. And the rating system was really to tell people, what is a green building? And how do you do one? And how will it change to the marketplace to the better? And that was the way that we got started. Essentially now, when we look at the idea of sustainability through the lens of green building, we basically say you build green, it saves energy, it saves money, it creates jobs, it improves infrastructure. And basically we grow this real estate market in an entirely different way. When you start to look at just what's happened on this campus, and you make believe that this campus is now a city, and you start to realize those activities are happening in every city in the United States and the great majority of cities around the world, you see the transformation is really beginning. We have 17,000, give or take, you know, the economy knocks out a couple of hundred here and a couple hundred there, but about 16,000 to 17,000 organizational members. One member is General Electric. One member is United Technologies. One member may be a small architectural firm with three people in it. But they're not individuals, they're organizations. We have 79 chapters around the United States. There's an upstate New York chapter that does a lot of the local level advocacy things and activities. Of all the LEED registered floor space, 40% of the large numbers I'm about to tell you happen outside the borders of the United States. So LEED is really a global phenomenon. It is not just US. And it's really interesting, you know, if you look just back to 2009, you know, US was the largest construction market in the world. You know, fast forward a few years out to 2020, it's not only China that is evolving to this massive scale, but look at what's going in emerging markets and what's happening there. the market is shifting in a very dramatic way. The good news from my perspective is they're doing this with green building and green technologies. And it's really amazing some of the places where this is happening. LEED is a global rating system, and it's basically a way of understanding a very simple set of ideas that take place within the building. You know, in any part of the building, the issues of energy, water, waste, materials, innovation, those things are all part of the equation. And when you change one, another one is changed as well. So understanding holistically how all of these things integrate is where the best opportunity for performance increasing in LEED is, for cost decreasing in LEED. It's the integration. If the windows, the lighting, the electronic controls coordinate with the mechanical systems, the heating and air conditioning, usually you can reduce your load in heating and air conditioning dramatically. You know, daylight, fresh air, all of the things that people like in these boxes that we're a part of. LEED was originally designed to take on the top percent of the market, the top 25% of the market. Our strategy today is really to focus in this spot of the 70% of the existing building market that has the most potential to do the most good relative to the work that we do. We talk about regeneration. Green buildings with the LEED rating system, you know, it's so funny. I think it's ingrained in us when we go to grammar school. You know, the biggest thing in our lives is coming home with a sticker, you know? And that sticker just says so much about my performance, Mom. Look what I did. I got a sticker. And things, as you progress in your jobs and your life and your age, trust me, it doesn't change. These, it may not be a sticker, it may be a really cool piece of recycled glass, but ultimately the award of understanding that your building now says something that it didn't say before is important. I want to show you one thing. This is going to be announced at our Green Build Conference in San Francisco, so many people haven't seen this yet, but do you see where this LEED plaque, this is the way plaques have been given out now for 11 years. It says U.S. Green Building Council. The next version of this, which we will announce shortly in at Green Build, will basically be LEED with U.S. Off of the plaque, U.S. Green Building Council off the plaque. The reason is, whether we like it or not, LEED is a global brand. And as a global brand, there are actual, you know, countries that don't tell me my building is great because the United States says it is. And I totally get that. As a marketer and as a business guy, I get that. So what we want, if LEED is being used in 120 countries right now, why would we not create a brand that evolves to the location as it is indicated? So LEED will in fact not have US on it. I guess I should ask you not to tweet that before I told you, but go ahead. Anyway, when people say, what's LEED, okay? This is my favorite slide. This shows you basically what LEED is. Okay, it's a box of animal crackers. And for 89 cents, you can understand how much fat, how much protein, how much carbohydrates and sodium is in a box of crackers. But until LEED, you never had the ability in a $90 million building to understand anything about it. You didn't know how much energy it used. You didn't know how much water it used, what the air quality was like, how much daylight is in there. You didn't know anything about the way the building operated so that you could make an intelligent decision. So in those wonderful, like, crazy years of the 1970s and 80s and 90s, you know, people made their decisions by, oh, wow, it's Italian marble. And, oh, it's like gold fixtures in the bathroom, as if you should touch anything in a bathroom, right? So what we've done is we've shifted this whole idea of understanding how buildings perform. And as you look at a building on campus or driving down the street, that you start to look at it with the idea of a nutrition label involved with it. How does it perform? Why is this box different? Why, and I think this is an apartment building in Santa Monica, if I'm not mistaken. Why is this building, why is the rent $30 more a month? you know, and well, it's $30 more a month, but ultimately my electricity savings is $186 a month. So maybe I can do the math and find out this is exactly the kind of place I want to live. But there's all kinds of great stories related to these buildings, and a lot of them are not apparent as you look at the structure. You don't know that it's got lower operating costs or higher occupancy rates or environmental stewardship associated with it, that there is a higher valuation if a developer wants to buy the building and then sell it again, that there's brand enhancement, there's recruiting differentiators in this kind of building. We're starting to see large-scale corporations, retailers, who are starting to use all of this as a differentiator in the marketplace. They know these buildings enhance the experience for shoppers. Daylight, good air quality actually makes all of us spend a lot more time in a retail setting, and if we do, it's proven that we spend more. Now, retailers love that. I'm not sure that's a great thing for the future of sustainability, but the bottom line is any building that enhances us as humans, we do better in. We have improved test scores in green classrooms. We have better health opportunities in green hospitals. Workplace settings in factories, higher quality levels, higher output, less incidence of workplace injury. All these things working together to give us a much more favorable experience. One of the things, you know, when developers say that these buildings help them attract tenants, that's a really important thing. That they're cost effective. You know, Adobe did three buildings, identical towers in California, and the amount of savings that they achieved out of that, those simple renovations, is just astounding. And increased rental rates is happening all around the world, actually. This is the shot of the Bank of America Tower at One Bryant Park in Manhattan. What's interesting about this is the Bank of America has most of the building. There's three or four floors of traders on the floor there. It's one of the few trading offices in Manhattan that actually has streaming daylight through the whole facility. People talk about, you know, well, my rates of rental are up a little bit and this and that. But what Bank of America, an executive told me, which he won't put in writing and we can't basically say, is that, so get your Blackberries out. What basically was saying that if a trader makes a mistake with their finger, you know, and literally they are trading commodities in seconds, right? You make a mistake because, you know, the air conditioning is off and you're hot and you're stuffy and the desk stinks, it's got formaldehyde off-gassing, and you know, you're a little bit hungover maybe from last night, and you got four or five other stimulus going on, and the computer's glaring and all these things are happening, you know, you might hit that keystroke one more time, causing Bank of America, Wells Fargo, PNC, any other bank you're working for, that might be $1 million mistake. That may be a $5 million, $10 million, $100 million mistake, and they have been made before. But in taking a little bit of an edge off of that equation, having good air quality, great daylight, all these things that make a person feel calm and connected and relaxed, and the ability to do that actually saves them many, many millions of dollars. We just don't know what the amount is, but it's high. We have about 135,000 LEED projects right now. This number changes daily. And I'm just going to flip through a few of these. I mean, the spaces, as you've seen here on campus, are pretty spectacular. The buildings, they do something different. I got in a discussion with one of the groups earlier, and this is actually a good juxtaposition, because I said, you know, some of the designers have basically given the new emerging world of green buildings and LEED buildings the idea that it needs to be, you know, glass and steel, edgy, German-designed looking, and ultimately that's a green building. But what we really see on a daily basis is we see all building types being used and designed. They can be Gothic, they can be, you know, original exterior, make it look in a campus setting you wouldn't even know that it was a building that had a previous life to it. Retail settings, apartment buildings, all of these things beginning to have a way of transforming cities and the way we think about these boxes. This one right here is the, not McGraw-Hill, it's the other one, Hearst Corporation in New York City. And let me just run back to Hearst. They went through and they did a LEED Gold design of this building, new construction on a big part of it. They basically loved what happened on the Gold experience so much, they've just brought the building through LEED for existing building and achieved a LEED Platinum on that. So it's, LEED is also a way of people managing a process, and it really helps them think better about cost savings and all of the associated things. But the designs are beautiful. A staircase kind of similar to the one you've got here in the building, which is beautiful. And these are the spaces that really make you think differently about the future. We have more than 2 billion square feet of LEED certified space right now just on the commercial side. And we are certifying somewhere between 1.8 and 2 million square feet every single day. So when you start looking at those numbers, you realize you've reached a little bit of a tipping point. Another indicator that I love to talk about is the fact that we've got more than 180 or 90,000 LEED green associates and green accredited LEED accredited professionals. And these are the folks that basically, you know, study for the exam, take the test, and have the ability to bring a project through the process and evolve it into a LEED rated building. You have new construction, you have design and construction homes, operations and maintenance, neighborhood development, and building design and construction, all as individual areas of expertise, with LEED Green Associate and LEED AP being the two massive bookends on either side. Now, Sheila mentioned that I am also a chair of the World Green Building Council. I don't want to confuse you with that. I just wanted to let you know the World Green Building Council is essentially a council of councils. USGBC is one of now 90 countries around the world that have formed an organization. Many of them, about 35 of them, want LEED to be their rating systems. Some of them, like the UK, wants to keep the BREEAM system as their rating system. Australia, South Africa have the Green Star system. Germany just developed their own system. You'll see other countries wanting, I think Vietnam is developing their own system. China has their own. The United Arab Emirates has their own. But the multinationals in all of those countries bring LEED to those countries as well. So sometimes buildings are dual rated. But you get to see, you know, just some of the councils there. There's 20 of the original founding members. More nine are emerging. These numbers change almost on a weekly basis. We had 26 green building councils in 2007. We have about 90 today. And you know, the information is—it's really interesting when you start to look at where you think globally this is all going on. You're exactly right to assume that China and India and Brazil are the 800-pound gorillas, and they are. But you know, who would think that, you know, Moscow is spending $24 billion on new housing? And you start to look at $450 billion in infrastructure going on in Russia. These are things you don't normally think. And the great majority of these things are happening in a green way. Right now in Saudi Arabia, this is Kuwait, and that little one there is Oman up in the top right corner in Jordan. When you start to look at the amount of money, $400 billion, $170 billion, $78 billion, that's being spent on intelligent green infrastructure, mass transportation, renewable energy, cogen plants, all of the things that have the ability to transform their markets. You know, people don't talk about the Middle East as an emerging powerhouse in sustainability. But you look at the way that this is a hotel in Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah Financial District, all of these buildings being rated with a LEED rating system. King Abdullah University, I believe, is LEED Platinum. This energy city in Qatar, they have 560 buildings going up. The first 60 are LEED Gold. The first 10 mosques are LEED Platinum. And it's just mind-boggling to see the amount of change that's happening. And I wish I had 1,000 employees that were all multilingual, and it's happening that quickly. So, and this is another one of Mostar, who actually started out saying they were going to build their own rating system and are now evolving everything that they have built to LEED existing buildings. But what LEED is doing is we've created, for the countries that want to use the LEED rating system, we actually have created a round table. And these folks come together, and country by country, they use what we call alternative compliance paths in order to look at the issues that are most important in their countries. If you think about water, the way the LEED rating system in the United States addresses water in the United States, you know, even if in Phoenix, Arizona, it's a heck of a lot different than Seattle, Washington. Well, can you imagine in Doha, the differences in understanding the requirements for water and LEED relative to what we would consider normal practice? So the folks in Qatar actually have the ability to adjust the LEED rating system. The rating system is then passed back through the LEED steering committee, and ultimately it's evolved into an alternative path for them. The way that we are looking at the future, because so much is happening so quickly, and we love this quote from Drucker that says, you can't manage what you can't measure. So what we're starting to understand is green buildings built for the sake of getting a LEED rating and then staying static for the rest of their lives really doesn't do anybody any good. I mean, you can mismanage a LEED platinum building in 12 months and have a below certified non-performing building. If people don't respect the plug loads, if people don't change the filters, if people abuse the lighting, the way that the controls are running the lighting, if you don't care about how you clean your carpets and what toxic chemicals you're using, you can actually undo everything you did. So through BPP, what we're doing is we're creating a partnership with all LEED certified buildings that make the certification process the beginning of the journey, not the end. The day you get your plaque, it doesn't mean we're done. It means, great, we just got married and we're now going to go through life together. I like that. I just made that up. but what it does is it will give an owner a report card and give you the ability to see where your energy performance is in relationship to your building, to relationship to other buildings that are of similar performance type, give you the ability to understand water in the same way and evolve to a place where the persistence of performance is really the best part of, I think, LEED going forward. Another thing that's really, I think, one of the coolest things that we're doing right now is called GBIG. And again, let's remember, we're driving by this building in Santa Monica and we don't really know what it is, and we think it looks like the designers have helped us enough to think it looks like a LEED building, but dear God, there's a 7-Eleven in the basement, so maybe it can't be, although 7-Eleven is actually building a lot of LEED stores right now, so that thing goes away. But we know that there is information here that we would like to better understand for a variety of reasons. So what we've decided to do is re-engineer that whole experience. Now, when you look at the whole world of LEED today, there are so many things going on, the BPP side, Autodesk, and all the work that we're doing related to the external influence of software. There's selection, documentation, submittal, data capture, analytics, planning, strategy. Who the heck can make any sense out of that? So the way that we're doing this is simple. It is the way that we're living our lives today. And this is, I get excited about a lot of stuff, but the way that a couple of our designers have taken GBIG, it's a free app on iPhone, GBIG Explorer and GBIG Exchange. It's GBIG Analyst and Explorer at the bottom, but just if you just put in search GBIG, you'll be able to pull down at least one of those right now. I think Analyst is being worked on right now, but Explorer is there. But essentially what it does is it allows you to take your iPhone and in any, it says, would you like to use your current location? So I'm in Santa Monica. I say yes. Actually, what is this? This is Chicago. I'm in Chicago. I say yes. So I have the ability to there are so many LEED buildings right now in an area like Chicago that we can't use leaves anymore. We like the little oak leaf, but now we're using little dots. So it's a scatter diagram of dots and colors. You get to see silver, gold, and platinum. But you have the ability now to populate by case studies what are the LEED buildings that I'm seeing? I'm on this street. You can actually stretch it. It goes right down to the street name. It separates the buildings, gives you the ability to touch the building, tells you what the building is. You can now search individually in the building. It'll show you the picture of the building. It'll give you the information behind it, who developed it, when they did it, when they got the rating, where did they get their points in LEED. How will this data relative to, this is a comparison chart of sustainable sites. If you look at the bottom left, sustainable sites, the water, energy, materials and resources, indoor environmental quality, and so forth. It shows you their scorecard over to the right, how many points they got. This one got 52 points. It shows you all of those in relationship to the local buildings around it, but also gives you the ability to say, I'm in Chicago, you know, and they're always competitive with New York City. You know, if this same building at this same square footage was done in Manhattan, would I have performed higher or lower? So you can actually score yourself against different cities and so forth. And it's a really good tool. I mean, if you're in real estate, if you're a broker, if you're a designer, if you are buying space, if you're leasing space, no matter what kind of box, again, that we're going after, this information can be a really valuable tool for us. One of the things I don't want to ever forget is that we talk about boxes, we talk about performance, we talk about energy, water, waste materials, but we can't forget that the most important part of why we're doing any of this is for the human beings that are in these boxes. There'd be no reason, everything we do for the environment, we do for human beings, because without a planet, there's nothing left to do something for. So the same way with the buildings, we do great buildings. When I walked around your buildings here today, what I was actually blown away by is I'm looking at these hallways filled with daylight and these natural woods and finishes, and there's no toxic smells, and you know, everybody I met just looked like happy and pleasant, and you know, and trust me, I've been to really bad buildings where that's not the case. So having this experience that you know, humans matter is a really important thing. I think it shows that we know that the human is integral to the transformation of what we're trying to do here and how we live our lives, but we also know that there's a solid economic case in all of this. And the more that I can prove that we are absolutely creating value, creating jobs, creating economic development, that we are able to do all of this in the name of a healthier planet and a healthier human population, then I think that we've got no problem moving this thing to a $10 trillion market in a very short period of time. We've got every indicator that says that it's possible. And actually right now, because of the hobbled American political spectrum, you're actually seeing some of this stuff happen around the world even faster. And I think when people will take out sustainability out of the political discussions, it doesn't belong there. It doesn't belong in any of those discussions at all. Healthy people that live their lives in a meaningful way with respect for their planet, with respect for their communities, why is that a political discussion? It should never be. And that's a really important part of, I think, what we're trying to do. We're trying to restore the way that we think. We're trying to go back to a way that I think that through colleges and universities, through K-12 schools, we have one of the greatest opportunities that we can imagine. So much so that what we did at USGBC is we formed the Center for Green Schools. And I have a vision that I hope comes to fruition. We started the center. We got a very nice donation of money from United Technologies. Thank you very much. And this center is operating almost as a separate NGO within USGBC. And I have this vision, and it's like, and I forgot which like Star Wars movie I saw or something, but you know, like the big like mothership is exploding and going down, and all of a sudden there's this launch out of all these little life pods. And I would love to have, and we're actually looking at a center for health and a center for affordable housing and a center for innovation. And what I would love someday, not that USGBC will ever explode and go downward, but I would love the idea that these life pods actually launch and the people that are focused completely on schools. And when I say, you know, the ability to focus on schools, it's a pretty sophisticated program. I mean, it has the ability to transform the lives of the children that we're talking about all around the world, we think within a generation, so that's 25, 30 years. It's about buildings, it's about curriculum, it's about the community. But when we think about launching a separate organization to do that, that's all their day job will be. This is what they will manage. And driving everything towards this goal of getting those kids in a green school within a generation is really critical. Right now, numbers that people don't usually see, 25% of the population goes to school every day. Kids, administrators, teachers, and so forth. 133,000 K-12 schools and 4,300 colleges and universities. And for God's sakes, if you go into any K-12 school in the United States, go to the nurse's office, and usually, and it's the worst one that I saw was I was touring, you know, a really lousy school. I'll show you a picture of it in a minute. And it was in Washington, D.C. And as we walked by the nurse's office, I saw something that looked like modern art on the wall. And I, you know, I was like, wow, that art is out of place in this really awful building. So as I walked closer, what I saw was a pegboard, and it was filled with at least 300 puffers in all different colors. And these were for children that every day got two or three puffs because their asthma is getting so bad and they have the inability to breathe on their own. This was the school, it's in Washington, D.C., fully operational. And, you know, this is where the next generation of kids are supposed to be inspired. This is going to transform them into human beings that, you know, care about their communities and care about their cities. And so what we're trying to do is put a face on the idea that these buildings may in fact, school buildings for K-12 kids might in fact be the most important box that we need to focus on right now. I think healthcare right after that. But boxes for kids in education, for teachers and students to have a meaningful connection might be the most important thing. When you can take this, this is a Washington, D.C. Middle school. This is a high school, Tarkington School in Chicago, Illinois. This is one a school that is in one of the worst neighborhoods in South Chicago. It is right plucked down in the middle of what I guess they used to call the projects. I don't know really what the definition is now. So many of them are in uninhabitable. It's a very depressed area. So this school is there. It's a LEED Gold high school in the middle of town. And the best story, I hear stories about the kids and how what it means to them. They go there and all of a sudden their attitudes have changed. They feel more engaged. They feel like this means something to them. But the best story I heard is whatever you call the, I don't know, I guess you could call it a gangsta. Is that a gangsta? I don't use that term a lot, as you can tell. But the folks that are the most disruptive to society in those neighborhoods actually have put the word out that no one can tag this school with graffiti. Because this school all of a sudden is like this beacon of hope in an area that no one ever cared about. And they have put out a word that you will not touch this building. And this building today stands in the midst of rubble, it stands as this untouched beacon of hope, which I think says a lot about the kind of the whole idea of what this means. One of my almost last stories, but I think another one of my most important, I actually took this photograph the October before the January. January was the earthquake in Haiti. The October before, I was invited to go to Haiti on a trade mission with President Clinton, Dr. Paul Farmer, amazing human health guy. A couple of folks on education. I was the building and energy guy, and there were two or three others. We flew to Port-au-Prince. We toured factories. We toured schools. It was the most amazing thing you could ever imagine. And then in January, the earthquake struck. And this right now is the way children are going to school in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince today, right now. And I give them credit. I'm not sure I would even get out of bed. But this is the world that they live in. So what USGBC decided to do, we partnered with HOK Architects, and we are building right now. It's not out of the ground yet. We bought the land. Well, we raised almost $1 million. We got another $250,000 to raise. And we are building a LEED Platinum orphanage in Port-au-Prince. And this project, Haiti project, and it was amazing. I met a great group of students here today, and I know many of them are in the room, and it's CUSD. CUSD. Great folks, great projects. And, you know, this is kind of similar to the stuff that, you all have worked on. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to get these kids into a setting. This building is 100% off the grid, uses no energy, collects all its rainwater. It will have beds for sleeping, it will have classrooms, and it will have a small health clinic inside of it. And taking everything that we've done and everything we've learned at USGBC and being able to do these kinds of things, it goes back to what my friend Paul Hawkins says, that everything is connected and no one thing can change by itself. We've got to understand every one of us are studying something different in this room. Every one of us has aspirations that are different from another. But if our common thread is not only the world that we live in, but the idea, let's say sustainability is important to us, and I'm guessing because you're sitting here tonight listening to me that you care about this to some degree, you will find immense opportunities when you hit the world out there to get a job and to do those things. Every one of those can tie back to sustainability if you want it to. Even if it's not in your job description, you will find the ability to do it because of organizations and opportunities and all of the kind of things that we work in today. Last couple of slides. Majora Carty, I don't know if anybody knows her, but she runs the Sustainable South Bronx Project in New York. She's on our board of directors. She is an amazing transformative leader. She said these simple words to me one time, and I can't get them out of my head. And she said, you don't have to leave your neighborhood to find a better one. And Majora's story is she grew up on a really, really lousy street in the Bronx. She was born there. She grew up there. She rented a place about a block away, and then her husband and she got married many years later, and then they bought a place about a block away from that. So she hasn't gone too far in the Bronx, but what she has done is through her programs and her leadership and everything she's been able to do, she's had tremendous impact on that community. They have parks, they have green space, they have green buildings and an awareness of job creation and all these things, and it's because Majora stayed and decided to do something different. Now, my own version of the Bronx is my little backyard in Syracuse, okay? So this is my backyard, and you know, if you look in the middle of those trees there, and I got a close up a little bit, you see that green behemoth coming through the trees there. So about a year ago, my son was on a fellowship in Cambodia, and he called me up and he said, hey, you know the school next door? Well, this is the elementary school where my son and my daughter both went, you know, Cherry Road School. He said, yeah. He said, you know, they're doing like a huge renovation, big addition, you know, and it's got to be LEED rated. And I said, well, how do you know it's not? And he said, I've got contacts. Now, meanwhile, he's in Cambodia. He's telling me what's going on down the street from me. So I went to a school board meeting, and I had the developers all sitting there, the construction folks, and I raised my hand and didn't say who I was or mention my background, but I said, are you doing this in a sustainable way? And they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to save energy. We're going to put PV on the roof. We're going to do this. And I said, is it going to be a LEED building? And they're like, oh, no, we can't afford that. We're not going to do that. And you know, first my head was going to explode, but then I decided I was going to go a different route. So I looked at the construction company, which is Turner Construction, and I said to them, you know, my name is Rick Fedrizzi, and I'm part of the U.S. Green Building Council, and I could see them like turning like shades of white. And I said, you know, the last 100 LEED projects you did for not one penny more than conventional construction. I know that because I saw the documentation. I know your company's reputation. I said, why would this little school district think that it's going to cost more to do this? Well, you should have seen the finger pointing, and I don't know, and he doesn't, but I will, and we'll get back to you. And everything. Anyway, long story short, because I opened my mouth in this meeting in my own hometown, this is now going to be a LEED Gold school. And it's one of those moments. It took me 57 years to realize that every one of us has a voice. And all you have to do is take that moment to pick what battle are you going to stand your ground on? Where have you said enough's enough? I choose to make sure that people know that this is important to me. So, you know, I made that statement to them. I got the neighbors rallied. I, you know, did a little social activity there. It was kind of fun. I enjoyed it. And I'm not used to that. So it was great. But and now I'm on a kick because they want to go to Home Depot and get these little tiny plants to stick in for landscaping. And I'm like, that's not going to work. You know, I mean, you need mature trees. This is a established neighborhood. You need to make this happen. Anyway, that was a long way of saying that it was a really great experience. Second to last slide, GreenBuild is our conference. We will be in San Francisco in November, expecting 40,000 people. And very, very excited about that. So anybody who wants to come out next November, please, you're all welcome. And thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.